Good afternoon. I'm Sarah Collins, Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund. Thank you for joining us for this briefing and Q&A on how the American Healthcare Act, or the AHCA, passed by the House of Representatives would change the Medicaid program and impact states' economies. I'm here with three leading experts on the Medicaid program who will present perspective on the role that Medicaid plays in states and how jobs, hospitals, and state revenue will be affected if the law is passed. Cindy Mann is a partner at Manatt, Phelps, and Phillips, where she guides states and stakeholders on health reform, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and delivery system transformation. She formerly served as the Deputy Administrator at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and Director of the Center for Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program Services at CMS. Leighton Koo is Professor of Health Policy and Management and the Director of the Center for Health Policy Research at the George Washington University's Milken Institute of Public Health. He is the lead author of a recent report on the economic effects of the AHCA. Al Dobson is a health economist and president of Dobson, Davanzo & Associates. He will be presenting new results from a Commonwealth Fund study he is leading on the effects of the AHCA on safety net providers. Before turning to Cindy, I'm going to provide some brief background on the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion and the changes proposed under the AHCA. Please go to Exhibit 1 in the chart pack. 31 states and the District of Columbia have expanded eligibility for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. While there have been significant improvements in insurance coverage in every state since the law passed, the gains have been the greatest in states that expanded their Medicaid programs. Exhibit 2. States that expanded Medicaid have also seen the greatest improvement in the ability of lower-income adults to get health care. In this study by Ben Summers of low-income adults in Arkansas and Kentucky, two states that expanded Medicaid, and Texas, which did not expand, adults in Arkansas and Kentucky reported increases in getting regular care for their chronic conditions, reduced use of the emergency room, and improvements in self-reported health status. Exhibit 3. The AHCA makes two major changes to Medicaid. First, it phases out the ACA's Medicaid expansion by reducing federal spending for states that expanded their programs. Second, the AHCA goes beyond the Affordable Care Act and makes a fundamental change in the federal government's contribution to the traditional Medicaid program, essentially placing a limit on how much it pays states. This part of the program provides care to more than 60 million people, including the elderly, disabled, children, and pregnant women. Exhibit 4. These changes to Medicaid are the deepest cuts in federal spending on the program since its inception in 1965. CBO projects that if the AHCA were to become law, states would see a loss of nearly $1 trillion in federal support over the next decade. I'll now turn this over to Cindy Mann.
Thank you, Sarah, great to be with everybody today. So I'm going to give a bit of an overview of the AHCA's changes with respect to Medicaid and highlight at least some of the potential ways in which the Senate may be taking up the bill. So if you would turn to slide 7, the first really is to remind everybody that the changes in the AHCA relating to Medicaid go well beyond the changes in Medicaid that were precipitated by the Affordable Care Act. So I think, as we all know, the bill is fashioned as a repeal and replace of the ACA, but the changes to Medicaid go well beyond the ACA-related changes. And so in this slide, we're just reminding folks that the largest single group of enrollees in the Medicaid program, which you see on the left side of the Exhibit 7, are children. Children really weren't affected in very significant ways in the Medicaid program by the ACA. They will be very significantly affected under the AHCA. And at the same time, what you also see in this exhibit is that the largest dollars, expenditures in the Medicaid program, are for the elderly and the disabled, also not directly affected by the ACA, but very much affected by the AHCA. And with respect to the elderly and the disabled, it is both health care coverage that Medicaid pays for, but also long-term services and supports. So if you go to the next slide, slide 8, you see this is sort of a parallel slide to the one that Sarah showed you a minute ago about the dollar reductions in the AHCA. This shows the coverage reductions in the AHCA as estimated, projected by the Congressional Budget Office. And they're here for Medicaid and for all other people with other sources of coverage. And you see that Medicaid really bears the largest hit in terms of the reduction of coverage reaching 14 million people in 2026. If we go to the next slide, which is slide 9, it shows you a little bit of what's called trigger states. So let me back up a minute. One of the key policies and the one that probably is most familiar to you all in the AHCA as it affects Medicaid is that it would end the expansion funding, the enhanced funding for states to do the Medicaid expansion for adults under the bill as approved by the House of Representatives. The expansion funding would end in January of 2020, except for people who had been covered under the expansion in that state as of the end of December of 2019. So those grandfathered individuals get the enhanced funding over time, but any new people that are covered don't get that enhanced funding, and those grandfathered people are only get the expansion funding if they remain in the program without a break in coverage that's more than 30 days. So both CBO and we, having looked at the experience in other states, project that most of those individuals in the expansion group would lose their coverage within 2 to 3 years because of the just the normal course of turnover in the program. The Senate bill is thinking about, at least we hear that the Senate is thinking about phasing out the end of the expansion funding so that it wouldn't drop just in, you know, one moment on 2020. It would gradually decline over some period of time, unclear how long that time is. But we point out in this slide that there are some states that would automatically, at least under current state legislation, lose their expansion if there was any change in the match rate, even if it was a phased-out expansion in the match rate. And as you all may recall, when states did the expansion, they were concerned that the federal government kept its commitment for the expanded dollars. And so many states, like these seven states identified here, actually put in their state legislation that the expansion will end if there is a change in the match rate. And certainly we expect other states that don't have these trigger provisions to take a serious look at the expansion if the match rate is retained but brought down. If you look at page 10 or slide 10, I want to move to the other key issue in the AHCA affecting Medicaid that has actually gotten less attention but perhaps is even more sweeping in terms of its implications for the Medicaid program. Since the Medicaid program was started in 1965, there has been a full federal commitment to share the cost of the program between the states and the federal government. And as Sarah talked about, there's a match rate that defines what that share will be, but it's never less than 50% of the cost. And in some states, it goes to 74% of the cost. And as we know, for the expansion population, it's even higher. And it's higher for some other populations and some other services. But the point is that the way the program is financed is that all costs, including unanticipated costs, which are you don't know when they're going to happen. The only thing you know in healthcare is that they will happen, right? That they'll be maybe higher than projected enrollment due to an economic downturn. Maybe drug costs will rise. Maybe there'll be a public health epidemic like the one we're experiencing with the opioid crisis. That we expect new breakthrough treatments, cancer treatments, genetic testing treatments. All of these costs will no longer be shared if they're not built into the caps, be shared by the federal government. All the risks of these costs will be borne by states, the program, and the beneficiaries. If you go to slide 11, it describes a little bit how the caps are computed in the AHCA. They are called per capita caps, meaning that they're derived from the historic spending in that state on different eligibility groups. So it's per person. So there's going to be a cap for the elderly. There'll be a cap under the bill for the disabled, another cap for the children. And that's based on a state's historic spending in a base year. And then they apply, if you look at this diagram, in the bill, a trend rate. So you set the cap by the historic data, then you grow it over time by the trend rate. And the two trend rates used in the House bill are the medical CPI and medical CPI plus one. And then you figure out how many people you covered in each of those groups. You multiply it times that cap trended forward, and you come up with an aggregate spending cap. And that's what the state operates under the House bill. So if they start to spend over that cap, as derived under this formula, all the costs would be borne by the state. And if in the first instance, because they don't know what the cap will be, that they draw down some additional federal dollars above the cap, they will have to pay those dollars back in the next year. There's a clawback in their next year's funding. So as you see from this slide, the key issues are, how is the base rate figured out? How is the trend rate figured out? But at the end of the day, however the cap is figured out, all of the costs above the cap are borne by the states, or the states will cut back the program to keep under the cap. If you look at the net...
Cindy, this is Sarah. I think we might have to have you wrap up pretty soon so we can get moved to late. And
okay, so sorry. So I'll just go quickly. The next slide shows that there are big base differences in states. This looks at 2011 data, and that's what a cap does, is freeze in those base rates. Slide 13 shows you what the trend rates would have looked like relative to spending in the Medicaid program in the last decade, in 2000 to 2011. And what I want to get to just very briefly, and then I'll end, is if you flip to slide 15, 14 and 15 tell you that these trend rates are inherently unpredictable. They're very volatile, and so how a state fares under the cap will really depend on not just which trend rate is picked, but what the trend rate is. And so you see different numbers here posed for one particular state on slide 15 if the trend rate turns out to be 3.7 for medical CPI, or if it's actually 3.2. And then finally on slide 16, we just want to bring you back to who the program covers for this same state that we just used as a sample. It doesn't really matter which group went over their caps. At the end of the day, a state will have to manage under the cap, and it will look to probably impose the cuts where the spending is the greatest, again, back to the elderly and the disabled. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. And we'll now turn to Leighton Koo.
Thanks, Sarah and Cindy. And what Cindy said was a great start to sort of note what our study is. Our study, I will say, not only looks at the potential changes in Medicaid, but the entire scope of the American Health Care Act. So that includes changes in the sort of premium tax credits that help people buy individual health insurance, as well as the tax changes. There are a number of taxes that are repealed. Primarily, there are taxes on high-income people. The American Health Care Act repeals many of those as well. So if you turn to what is numbered slide 18, the Congressional Budget Office and others have examined what are the effects of the Health Care Act on insurance coverage. They estimate 23 million more people uninsured. As both Sarah and Cindy said, they expect 14 million of those people who lose coverage are people who receive Medicaid, and that's because of the whole range of changes in the Medicaid expansions, the per capita caps, and some other changes. What we do in our study is we try to look at the potential effects of these changes on economies and employment, not just in the health sector, but the overall economy of the state, the overall total number of jobs in each and every state and the District of Columbia over the next decade or so. We align this with the estimates that were produced by the Congressional Budget Office, but then we try to sort of specify it for each state. We're using a well-known regional economic model, the PI Plus model. that's developed by a firm called REMI, Regional Economics Models Incorporated. So if you turn to slide 19, that's really sort of the summary of what we find that we think many people will pay attention to. So if you look at the bottom line, the scale is years over time and then total number of jobs plus and minus. The red line stands for total employment. So this is the total number of jobs at this point in the nation. And we estimate that at the beginning, because of the taxes that are repealed, and that's the very first part that goes into effect of the American Health Care Act, is repealing taxes. The federal government actually goes into deficit of around $100 billion for a couple of years under the American Health Care Act. So that strengthens the economy because there's more money that's staying in states and in consumers' hands. As the health care cuts proceed, and they get deeper and deeper in every year under the American Health Care Act, then there are losses that begin to occur among states. And so that's why you see the total employment line beginning to drop down consistently from around, you know, really starting off in a serious way just after 2019 and 2020, falling in the end to 2026 to almost a million jobs that are lost across the U.S. We note that one specific sector that is hit very hard, and this is not a surprise, is healthcare. Healthcare actually begins to experience losses in jobs from the very beginning, and then by the end, 2026, there are 725,000 jobs lost in the healthcare industry. So these are people working in hospitals, doctors' offices, clinics, you name it. What this also means, if you think about it, is that by that time, actually the job losses have spread to other areas too. So they're now hitting in areas like construction, retail, finance. So there are broad losses, and we would expect over time, if you go beyond this window, that those trends continue. So this is why this is sort of a broad concern. It's worth for a moment, actually, just stepping back before we advance to slide 20. So staying back with 19, why there are these effects. And so it's worth thinking, under the Health Care Act, funds first go from the federal government to Medicaid and to pay for people's health insurance. So the first stop, as it were, is funding for health care. But what hospitals, doctors, offices, et cetera, do with most of their money is they pay their employees. They also buy goods from other places, such as they buy goods to help pay for their space costs, their equipment costs, and so on. Now, what happens is when employees lose their jobs or have their hours cut back or their salaries cut back, they have less money to spend on general consumption items. So they have less to spend on food, housing, transportation. They can't go to the movie theater quite as often. So there are broad reductions that affect sectors outside the healthcare sector. And so this is why this begins to affect total employment. What I'll say on the tax side is taxes do boost employment if there are some gains in states' economies. And again, the federal government is actually going to deficit in the first couple of years. What I will say is different is that we know from research that taxes are, particularly tax cuts for the wealthy, are not as effective, not as efficient in translating into employment. They don't stimulate the economy in the same way simply because high-income people do not spend all the additional money that comes out. There's what's called a reduced marginal propensity to consume. So next slide. Now we're going to slide 20. So this is a summary for those of you who are numerically inclined of the general effects of the bill. So we do see that the tax repeals essentially increase funding that's going to states. Basically, the federal government is going to deficit for that. The coverage-related spending is cutting funding that's going to states and consumers, and so those are becoming deeper and deeper all the time. The net effect is in the beginning, in 2018, we say that there are some sort of gains in funding across states, but by 2026, there are deeper losses. We already talked about the health, the employment numbers and the health employment numbers. We also see that gross state product changes in business output changes across states. To give you a better sense, turn to slide 21, and this gives a better sense of the difference between the coverage-related changes and the tax repeal changes. The coverage-related changes, so the cuts in Medicaid, the cuts in premium tax credits to help people buy insurance, those almost consistently reduce employment, and so there are large effects. They are offset in part by the tax repeal changes, which, however, as I say, are really not as effective in stimulating growth. And it's those two combined effects of the law that lead to that net effect of around 1 million jobs lost by 2026. I'll say the major thing that's leading to the law, the cuts in coverage-related changes, are the cuts in Medicaid. As Cindy and Sarah said, those are the largest cuts. Conceivably, these could be worse. We'll add, when we've done some estimates of what the Trump administration has proposed, that could almost double the sort of loss of jobs associated with health, with the coverage-related changes, maybe another 1 or 2 million jobs lost. Again, if the Senate reduces some of the funding for Medicaid under its bill, these would be deeper than we're anticipating here. The next slide, slide 22, just gives a summary for a number of states. This has the top 10 states that are losing jobs. We expect New York to be number one, Pennsylvania to be number two. Florida, which is a non-Medicaid expansion state, is actually the number three. We also include a couple of the smaller states not in the top 10, Maine and West Virginia, just to show that, that really most of the states do experience losses. There are economic downturns that occur in almost all the states because of the American Health Care Act. And I think that's it for me.
Great. Thank you so much, Leighton. And we'll now turn to Al Dobson.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Al Dobson. I have Randy Hott in the room with me, who did much of the work. I'm starting on slide 23. I'll give a brief executive summary. The title is Financial Impact of ACA Medicaid Provisions on Safety Net Hospitals. So the first question is, what's a safety net hospital? A safety net hospital, of which there are 660 in our study, are those hospitals that disproportionately care for Medicaid and the uninsured patients. They're the guys who are on the front lines treating our Medicaid patients and the uninsured. There are many unknowns in all of the studies you've heard today that look ahead 10 years. One thing in particular on ours are some of the components of the ACA and how they impact on hospitals, and we have a table that goes to that. We use Medicare, we use total margins and operating margins as a financial measure. I think that the old adage, no margin, no mission, pretty well describes why margins are so important. If hospitals don't have financial resources, they can't modernize, they can't stay current with technology, and ultimately, if they have no margin, they go out of business. So if they get cut on their margins, they have two choices. They can either cut back what they do, or they can become more efficient, or they can go out of business. And the margins we'll look at today suggest there's going to be a lot of stress on safety net hospitals. Our analyses indicate that a couple things. One, ACA will penalize those safety net hospitals with the greatest commitment to Medicaid and uninsured patients, just exactly the opposite of what you'd like to see. ACA's impact on margins depends upon many aspects that are not well publicized, for instance, what's called a three-month retroactive eligibility, and again, I have a table for that. Ultimately, if safety net hospitals are weakened financially and cannot invest and remain current with technology, the entire patient community, I repeat, the entire patient community they serve is affected, not just the safety net populations. So this may be a Medicaid bill. And the ACA may go after the old bill. But what it does is it threatens in those communities that have safety net hospitals to care for all the individuals in those communities. What we're presenting today is an advanced release of our study. A more complete study will be available soon. Page 24. The purpose, then, is to examine how ACA Medicaid provisions, which we've just seen are $834 billion from a previous presenter, over 10 years will impact the financial stability of the safety net hospitals using hospital margins. Safety net hospitals were defined in our study as what's called deemed DSH hospitals. That's jargon. But what it essentially means are those hospitals with the highest level of Medicaid and uninsured patients. Again, 660 hospitals. We used an internal model that Randy and I have been working on now for a couple decades, and we've modernized it and kept it current as well with the studies that we do over time. Page 25. So now we're going to look at the components of what happens when you try to understand what is actually driving what we're looking at. So ACA Medicaid provisions will negatively impact safety net hospitals' net income. That is, most of them will. Some of them actually add revenues. There are five key Medicaid provisions that we modeled. And looking at the chart on page 25, we see that net income, where net income is revenues less cost, that's the money flowing through the institution after the costs are accounted for, $74 billion
in 10 years.
We eliminate the individual mandate and Medicaid expansion. We take about $20.4 billion off over 10. We gain dollars for Medicaid DSH reductions. That is to say, they're eliminated. We pick up $13.7 billion. We eliminate the 3-month retroactive eligibility, very jargony kind of term, but it's hugely important to hospitals. That's how hospitals get people put on the Medicaid program to pay the hospital bills through the Medicaid. If that goes away, 13.2, one of the largest numbers on the chart, and a number that most of us outside the industry aren't even familiar with. Then we have Cindy's per capita spending limits. Then we have the safety net funds, which were provided to the expansion states for
non-expansion
states, yes, for a total of about $18.2 billion, about a 25% cut in net income. Imagine your business cut 25% when you're already on the line. That's a lot of cut. So on page 26, we look at total margins, and we look at them over 10 years. The blue line on top is the current law, and the gray line on the bottom is the current law for the operating margins. Total margins are total revenues minus total cost over total revenues. Think endowments. Think return on investments. Think parking lot. Think cafeteria. All the stuff that gives hospital money. And as you can see, the total margins are well above the operating margins. The operating margins, however, clearly focus on patient care. Patient revenues minus operating cost over patient revenues. What we see is over 10 years, on page 26 again, we see that the numbers fall on the bottom line under the revisions for total margins from 5.9% to 0.5%. Very difficult to survive as a hospital on 0.5% margin. But operating margins show even more of a decline. They start lower, of course, 0.9%, and they fall to minus 6.4%, and the total is minus 3.6%. Not sustainable numbers. Again, hospitals faced with those kinds of pressures will have to do something. Out of business, less service, they're going to have to do something because those numbers are not sustainable. Just as a comparison, total margins overall in 2015 were about 6.2, and operating margins were about 1.5%. Page 27. Now we split the numbers into Medicaid expansion states and non-expansion states. And what we see is that the expansion states are hit the hardest, and for instance, under the proposed legislation, we'd start at 5.8% total margin and fall all the way to -0.5, which we've just seen under the Medicaid expansion states. And then on the operating margins, -1.9% down to 8.5%. The non-expansion states start a bit higher and end up a little bit higher, but still, negative 2% for total margin, negative 3.1% for operating margin is not a good territory for these kinds of hospitals that provide so much care that isn't otherwise paid for. Page 28. Now we see the safety net hospitals with the highest proportion of vulnerable patients would be hit the hardest. And we've divided it into thirds. The top panel shows total margin in 2026 and operating margin in 2026. And we see that the current law after the Auchin percent change, and the lowest guys, the ones that have the most Medicaid patients, the most uninsured patients, start with a zero margin, not a great place to be in, and they fall on total margin all the way to -4.7 in expansion states. The non-expansion states start a bit higher at 2%, they fall to 0.5% for a differential of 1.5. Operating margin is a similar kind of thing, where under the folks that have the most Medicaid and the most uninsured fall to fall by 6.3 percentage points to 18.6 percentage point operating margin, and not quite as bad, but still not so good. The safety net hospitals in non-expansion states end up at an operating margin at -4.5%. Bottom line, the expansion states start lower and they fall harder to the point where their operating margin on page 28 of -6.3, and those hospitals that are in the Medicaid expansion states that have the most care to the Medicaid patients and the uninsured. So what have we got here? How we appraise the numbers I've just presented you are that we've shown the pressures that this bill would put on safety net hospitals, those hospitals that treat our uninsured and our Medicaid patients. We see that we estimate that by 2026, total margins would drop to 0.5%, not sustainable as financial institutions, which hospitals are as well as clinical, compared to current law estimates of 2.9%, an 83% reduction. Safety net hospitals and Medicaid expansion states would experience the largest negative impact on margins under the AHCA, particularly small rural hospitals, and in many times they're the only hospitals in an area. They go bad, the neighborhood goes bad in terms of who's getting care not just the uninsured and the Medicaid patients. Safety net hospitals in states that expanded Medicaid may see uncompensated care costs more than double. And if your costs double, of course, your margins fall, particularly if your revenues are falling as well. Safety net hospitals that have the highest commitment to serving low-income and Medicaid patients tend to have the lowest operating and total margins under current law and will be negatively impacted the most by the AHCA. Then I'll finish with a refrain. That is to say, when you diminish the financial stability of safety net hospitals by AHCA or any other means, not only are the people affected Medicaid patients and the uninsured patients, but the entire community gets less care because a weakened hospital is a weakened hospital, not just for the Medicaid patients and for the uninsured. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Al. And we will open the floor to questions now.
And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star and one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. And we'll take our first question from Francine Kiefer with the Christian Science Monitor. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay,
hear you.
Great. Thanks for doing this briefing. It's very helpful. I have two very overall questions, contextual kinds of questions. Medicaid spending as a part of the federal budget, as far as I understand it, has grown from about 2% 30 years ago to almost 10% of federal spending now. So what has caused that much larger increase and growth of Medicaid as part of federal spending? And the second question I have is, Democrats now keep talking about Medicaid as a middle-class entitlement, no longer, you know, just for the poor. What is it about Medicaid that can characterize it, if you think that's true, that can characterize it as a middle-class entitlement? So why has it grown so much, and why is it a middle-class entitlement?
Cindy, would you like to take that?
Sure. I can jump in. Both great questions. So Medicaid definitely has grown over the decades, as you've noted, and it is now a significant program. The cost, the key reason for the cost increases has been it's covering more people. It's just been sometimes by state option and sometimes by federal changes. It has been covering more children, more pregnant women, more people with disabilities, more elderly, and then in the Affordable Care Act, it expanded to cover other adults who hadn't been covered, parents and so-called childless adults, up to 133% of the poverty line. So the actual per enrollee costs in Medicaid have grown more slowly than either commercial or Medicare. So it's not the per-person costs that have been skyrocketing at all. In fact, they've been well lower than what we've seen in other health coverage. But it is the fact that Medicaid is actually covering more people. On the issue of middle class, there are some middle class people that get help from the Medicaid program. That's not, the target of the repeal of the expansion are hardly middle-class people. Those are people under 133% of the poverty line. Many have, most have incomes, below poverty, below for a single individual, it's $1,000 a month in income. We're talking about people who often don't have enough money for food and for rent. But Medicaid is the default payer for long-term care. So if somebody needs nursing home care, if somebody needs long-term services and support in their home and in the community, there's very, very little Medicare coverage for that, and very few people have commercial long-term care coverage. Medicaid will cover people when they have exhausted their resources, when they have, maybe they're a year in the nursing home, 2 years in the nursing home, they've spent their resources, and then Medicaid will pick it up. That's not where the cuts are aimed at in terms of the particular policies. But we may see those middle-class individuals who rely on Medicaid's long-term care services very much affected by the changes.
Thank you.
I'll just add a second to that. As we age as a society, more and more of us are going to be old and frail. More and more of us are going to need long-term care support services, and more of us are going to look to the Medicaid program, and it certainly better be there, or we're going to have a lot of unhappy grandmas.
And once again, that's star and one to ask a question. We'll take our next question from Mark Davis with Senator Sherrod Brown. Your line is open. And Mark Davis, your line is open.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. I'm sorry I had the mute button. I didn't want to disturb everybody. In the event that I inartfully phrased this question, I just want to be clear that I don't speak directly for the senator, but the senator is very interested in these issues in large part because Ohio, as an expansion state, as Mr. Dodson referenced, we stand to be one of the people that are hardest hit. First, I was hoping, Mr. Dodson, if you could talk a little bit about the sort of issues that will affect states that became part of the Medicaid expansion and what their concerns and maybe some sort of action list would be. And then in addition to that, I was hoping that someone could just quickly address, in light of Francine's question, whether EMTALA costs are handled by Medicaid or whether they are not handled by Medicaid, because it seems like that obviously might, the Medicaid expansion might really just cover the EMTALA money, and I'm wondering whether that's true.
I'll take the question that was addressed to me. This is Al Dobson.
Okay.
The expansion states, take Kentucky, for instance, that had very low income levels for Medicaid, and it went up to 138%. Many counties in Kentucky went from amongst the worst coverage in the country to amongst the best coverage by that change. Folks in Kentucky are very concerned that eastern Kentucky and many of the rural counties, with the taking away and loss of the Medicaid expansion, the folks that are just now getting decent coverage under Medicaid, which is a very good insurance program, will lose their coverage. And as you may know, I don't want to pick on Kentucky, but they have some of the lowest life expectancies in the country. Those kinds of places, Ohio and the middle of the country, when you lose that Medicaid expansion, we're going to lose an amazing amount of care for a lot of people that they otherwise had started to get, and they'll lose it and won't have it anymore. And we pick up every day we hear about the kinds of impacts that's going to have, hugely important. And that'll roll right through, as my analysis said, to the hospitals. And if you don't have insurance and you're uninsured, safety net hospitals are a major source of care. But if they're threatened as well, that takes our safety net bulwark and the Medicaid program both at some risk if we unwind what we've done in the past several years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just as a point of curiosity, I hate to ask a follow-up there, but I was the Assistant Attorney General for 2 years and handled Medicaid waivers that provided for disabled individuals and for mentally challenged individuals. Are those going to be cut as well, do you think?
I can jump in on that. This is Cindy Mann.
Thanks, Cindy.
You know, how a state operates under the cap is going to be up to the state, meaning if it's facing a large amount of cuts because of the per capita cap, because of the loss of funding for expansion, if it chooses to keep the expansion going under the lower match rate. Mm-hmm. It'll be determined by them, but you know, states will have to go where the money is, and as the data show, the most of the dollars are supporting people with disabilities and supporting care for the elderly. So, and many of the services you identified or the populations you identified are so-called optional, meaning the states aren't required to necessarily keep that coverage going. So they're certainly at risk. And let me just, while I'm in the neighborhood, answer your EMTALA question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
If a hospital is providing the EMTALA-related service, which is to provide emergency care and or stabilize care for somebody coming into the emergency room, if it provides that service on behalf of a Medicaid beneficiary, whether it's an expansion beneficiary or a traditional program beneficiary, Medicaid does pay for that service.
Mm-hmm.
So reductions in Medicaid will affect hospital revenues with respect to their obligations to do EMTALA.
But if they don't have Medicaid coverage, do some of those funds come from Medicaid funds? I guess that's the better question in terms of the hospital making up the shortfall.
The only, you know, hospitals will get disproportionate share hospital payments, DSH payments.
Okay.
You know, and that varies by state as to how robust that is. So those payments would remain. They'd be cut for the expansion states for 2 years under the House bill, and then the cuts would be restored in 2020.
But Emtala primarily, if I come into a hospital, I'm uninsured. Under Emtala, and I come into the emergency room, I have to be stabilized and taken care of till I'm stable again. If I have insurance, not such an issue, because I have insurance. But if I'm uninsured, the hospital picks that up through its charity care and uninsured plan. If I don't have Medicaid, I don't have Medicare, I don't have commercial, the hospital's stuck with it, and that's what the law does.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was just mentioning that there is a separate stream of funds under DSH that could offset some of that.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Okay. I was just wondering if that, you know, in any way contributed to changes in Medicaid rates, you know, if some of the money was coming from there. But you've answered that question very well. Thank you so much.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. And we have no more questions at this time.
Thank you very much for listening. If you need additional information, we will be happy to try and provide that. Thank you.